Hi, everyone.
Hi.
We're Laura and Aria. Welcome to our podcast, Thoughts from Limbo. It's founded on the realization that that's all that life is, a giant state of limbo, one where we never have perfect information and there are no linear paths. All we can do is our best to navigate this big, beautiful mess. So come ride with us.
We bring you insights from successful entrepreneurs, creatives, and experts, people from different walks of life who can provide some of the answers to life's many questions and have a powerful story to share. They're all here to empower you, feed your curiosity, and help you navigate life, a life in limbo.
As always, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We love hearing from you.
In this episode, we talk to Ruth Van Reagan about the advantages and the hardships involved in growing up across cultures. It's a topic close to our hearts and one that's increasingly relevant in today's globalized world. Ruth is a writer, consultant, and speaker, and an expert on the third culture kid phenomenon. Her TEDx talk has been viewed by over 44,000 people across the world, and her experience as an adult third culture kid herself is especially relatable today, since many individuals are raised outside of their parents' native culture. She is the co-founder of the Families in Global Transition Forum that welcomes globally mobile individuals and families to share research and developing best practices that support their growth, success, and well-being of people crossing cultures around the world. Her first book, titled Letters Never Sent, introduces her experience as a US citizen raised for 13 years in Nigeria and dives deep into the significant losses that come with a cross-cultural and highly mobile lifestyle. Her latest book, Third Culture Kids, which she co-authored with sociologists David and Michael Pollack, gives a detailed overview of the third culture kid profile, including its historic origins, the benefits and challenges that come with a cross-cultural lifestyle, and covers important topics including grief, identity, relationships, and parenting, which we found particularly interesting. We're honoured and massively excited to have her on our podcast. Welcome, Ruth!
Thank you. I am excited to be here. I love it that your next generation is taking up the phone here and going to spread the word and keep going with what the work that we've started. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you. Welcome. And thank you for coming up with this whole concept. I'm 27 now and I never knew that this was something that kind of defined my personality pretty much.
That defined our life.
Yeah, really. Defined my life. Yeah. So if you could just give us an overview, kind of the definition of what the third culture kid is.
This is a concept actually that I didn't come up with, but in the 1950s, a sociologist from Michigan State, Dr. Ruth Yuseem, went to India with her anthropology husband, John Yuseem, and they were going to study how businesses worked when people from different cultures came together with their different cultural expectations and tried to form a relationship that worked, you know, for both of them. What they saw that was that for the people who were working, they had formed kind of an interstitial world, a place that was not quite the host country, which would have been in her situation, America, or the next one, which was India, but it was a way that was common to them. Far beyond that, what became significant to particularly Dr. Ruth Yuseem was noticing that the children whose parents had come from the States were different in several ways than the kids she taught back in Michigan State. In some ways, they were more mature than their age. They knew all about the world. In other ways, they were less mature. Mm-hmm. So she called them third culture kids because they were being raised in this environment and realized that it wasn't just Americans. It was British. It was not just business people. It was mission people. It was Foreign Service, it was military. And so that's where the concept began. People didn't believe that for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think it was such a new way of defining culture, but it was like this subcultural world. And it wasn't the kids took from both and made something new. It was a different way of life where you were living in this global transition between different countries and it was the normal way of life. So then later on, Dave Pollack went to Kenya and he was working in international school and he was one that really developed the profile. And I met him when I was in Liberia. As you said, I grew up in Nigeria, went to the States when I was 13 and had all the experiences that I have names for now, but I didn't then. All I thought was, what is my problem? I'm the weirdest kid that ever lived. And so when I was 39, I was trying to figure out my life story, where I had this wonderful life, but I had places of depression. And I was doing some journaling. In the middle of that, I got a survey to do for my children, because we were in Liberia and raising our kids there. They wanted to know about their educational process. And there was going to be this big conference on TCKs, particularly mission kids. So I wrote back, I sent the survey, and I said to Dave Pollack, who was organizing it, what are you doing for the adult? I grew up as a TCK, apparently. And my mother had just sent me an article that talked about TCKs. I'd never heard of them before. It was happening in that same time. And I said, so what are you doing for the adult? You're having this conference. I'm 39. Nobody ever told me my story before. Mm-hmm. So he wrote back, and I went to the conference, and he said, no, I think you're not alone. So that's how the whole process started for me, mm-hmm. of taking what I had lived, finding some language for it, and then starting to use it and to work with Dave Pollack. And I offered to help him write up his stuff, and then the editor wanted to know why the profile happened. So it kept emerging, and doing a lot of talking to people and research and trying to understand the why of the story, not just what, but why does it happen? So that was how I got into this. And I know that you can tell us your story in a minute, but before you do, I do want to say that as I was doing that and started, the first edition of the book came out in 99, I started to find out that people who had very different stories were relating to what we were talking about. And they wanted to know, were they a TCK or not? And the TCK thing had been about people whose parents had careers, but maybe they were refugees, maybe they had multicultural families. Mm-hmm. So I did realize that the story was getting more complex than how it was at the beginning. And so I put another umbrella over the TCK of cross-cultural kid. And looking at the world, how many people are growing up cross-culturally, TCK is one way. But I think you have some stories of extra layers of the complicated story that's becoming so common. So I'd love to hear more about yours.
I mean, there's obviously a lot of benefits, I think, that come from being a cross-culture kid or growing up in a different country. You know, I'm grateful for the fact that we speak multiple languages. I think it teaches you a lot of adaptability as well. You learn how to adapt to a new environment. I think there's also an increased sense of empathy sometimes. You know, we know a lot of people from different cultural backgrounds. And I think as an adult or in the world of work, you're always going to come across people from very different backgrounds. And I think that having this upbringing has definitely helped us
navigate through that.
Yeah, in a lot of aspects. But I personally also suffered a depression when I was slightly older. So we were born in Spain, all three of us. So we've got a younger brother as well. And then we moved to England twice, but definitively when I was almost 9 years old. So Naria
would have been... I was around seven.
Yeah, Naria was about seven. Aitor, our brother, was about five. He would have been almost five. And then we grew up for the rest of our lives in the UK. We studied in the UK. And I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to go back and live in Spain. And when I did go back to live in Spain, I was about 24 years old or something. And it wasn't at all what I had imagined. You know, we had kept in touch with all our family in Spain, but I moved to the capital. I moved to a different part of Spain. And it was a really weird experience where I felt like exactly kind of how you described, sort of, you know, your life's going great in many ways and you don't really know why it is that you feel how you feel. But I felt kind of like I belonged in two places. And at the same time, I didn't belong anywhere at once. And it was at that moment when I realized, you know, this is where I assumed I belonged, because I didn't really feel like I belonged necessarily in the UK. And then going to Spain and experiencing that I was still not 100% home was kind of, you know, it lifted the floor from under my feet and I felt completely destabilized.
Yeah, I felt that as well when I started to live in Spain 3 years ago now. And I'm not necessarily going to say I felt at home, but it was exciting just because I really wanted to live in that place. It was a new challenge. But I also I always felt that the UK was home. But then when I'm here, I don't feel as if I am like fully happy where I'm supposed to be happy. So I kind of have the same feeling where you're kind of in the limbo stage where you're not really in Spain or in England. You're just a mesh of both. And then some people see you as Spanish, and then in Spain they see you as English. So then when you go back to the original place, are you supposed to go off what other people say you are, or what you feel? Yeah.
Well, I think what you guys are saying is classic. And one of the reasons it's so important to normalize the story is because all of us felt, what's the matter with me? And one of the parts of the profile is called belonging everywhere and nowhere. That is classic, because we do fit in each place. And what we don't know at the time is, in a way, that becomes part of our skill set, that we can negotiate different cultural worlds, especially in a world like today. But we've all grown up with the concept that we have to be one or the other. And so we don't know how to put this together, or how to be both and, or that it's okay that we feel part of two different worlds. The fact that you guys also were really bilingual. Now, I grew up speaking Hausa when I was in Nigeria, but that language never helped me as an adult, because when I went back to the States, of course, nobody spoke it. And so I also came from a family that spoke English. I went to school in English. I went back to my home country in English, my passport country. And so even though I'm speaking another language, it was only relevant when I was in Nigeria. Now, I think for your generation, with many people growing up between different worlds like I did, but you have an added issue of language, which I think can complicate it, because you're switching languages, in a sense, at home, at school, when you switch countries. And I think that one of the things I'm learning as I'm listening to stories now is, in a way, we're in another complexity that we didn't know about before. How do we put the language piece in? And I wonder how that's been for you.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting, because I mean, all three of us have got different experiences of this, but because we speak Spanish at home, you know, what's familiar to you, what I identified was Spanish. And that didn't change despite the fact that we moved to England and we spoke English in school. We were still, I almost felt as though our family had grown up in a boarding school. I kind of, because we went back to Spain for the holidays and things. So I always felt like, okay, we live in England throughout the year and I'm in boarding school with my family here. We're a Spanish family in England and I can have friends, and I like a lot of aspects of England, but I always still felt Spanish. And I think that the language did have a lot to do with that.
100%. Because you see the Spanish language as home, because you speak it at home. You speak it when you're comfortable in your own environment at home. You express yourself, you express your feelings mostly with your family in that language. So for us, English was mostly just in school, really. We wouldn't really bring it into the house.
Yeah, which is why I found all the controversy around Ilaria Baldwin's, you know, that tweet that went viral, because apparently she had been faking her Spanish accent
and her name.
So she apparently in high school and in college, I think maybe she called herself Hillary, which makes sense just because it's a, you know, it's an easier to pronounce English name. And we were actually talking about this because in Spain they translate names. So for example, in Spain, Prince Harry, they call him Enrique. And Prince William, they call him Guillermo, which is a completely different name, very, like, way more different than Hillary is to Ilaria, which is essentially the same.
And Queen Elizabeth, instead of being Queen Elizabeth I, she's Isabel the First.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, it's, in a way, I get it in the sense that it's easier to pronounce in a language. It's strange, I think, to define somebody else with a different name anyway. But yeah, I think all this controversy around whether or not she has a Spanish accent just seems like there's such a lack of education around the fact that there's so many cross-cultural people. There isn't, you know, there isn't like a category that you have to fit into. Like Nuria and I don't have a particularly Spanish accent when we speak in English, but then you listen to our parents and they sound like Sofia Vergara on a good day. So yeah, I think it's so, I don't know.
Just, I think there's a lot of judgment in it when yeah, there really weird. Does not need to be that much judgment.
Mm. Well, I think you've brought up some super, super important topics that are part of the emerging awareness. Number one, every day you switch cultural worlds. See, when you went out to school, when you went in the dominant culture, you're operating in one place where you're presumed to be part of that culture, because I'm sure you adapted your way to fit in at school. So you were being British. And yet when you went home at night, you were somebody else. And the people at school didn't even know who you were when you went home at night. So I think that's layering complexity to it. Because even when I was a child, if I went and played with my African friends and spoke Hausa, that's fine. But really, I always knew I wasn't African. That was, and they knew it because the way I looked certainly was never going to allow me to be mistaken. Yeah. But especially when you look like either culture and you have a physical resemblance, you can be what we're called a hidden immigrant. The people look at you, but they make assumptions that aren't really understanding who you are inside, which is part of the story. What I just realized, though, you gave me a new thought. Probably every culture translates a different language's names. I think about the States and people come over with these Asian names.
Oh, yeah.
And so instead of us here trying or the teachers trying to learn the name, a lot of the time they say, well, I'll call you Bill. I'll call you something. What's your American name? And I have had some Asian medical students that I've met when they've come and they've worked with my husband at his clinic. And they all have, when they come, they introduce themselves by an American name. And I think, how did that happen? And they say, well, we had to figure out our name before I came because people knew that they could never say our real names.
Yeah.
That's part of, you know, you're just giving my brain a new thought today that maybe that is more universal than we know. But particularly the people that are criticizing Hilaria don't even know that they've required that change or something. Anyway, I think when I read that story yesterday about her, I thought again how much work still needs to be done because really people were shaming her for her story. And that's what I think has happened to so many cross-cultural kids is they've been shamed for their story instead of people understanding what they're experiencing is very normal. It's not a shame. It's not because they're deficient. It's not because they can't, you know, figure life out. It's because this is their story and they've grown up in different cultural worlds and had to navigate them. And actually, it's a skill set to do that.
Yeah, I think it's just the name thing for me is such a, I don't know, it's, I find it so controversial that people would critique her mainly because of the fact that your name just goes to the root of your identity. So even your accent goes to the root of your identity. Like so Nerea and Aitor, they have very difficult names to pronounce in English. My name in Spanish is pronounced Laura and it exists in English. It's just Laura. And even when people called me Laura, I felt really out of character almost. It took me a while. And I only, growing up, I was always, all my friends in school called me Laura because when we moved to England, we spoke zero English. So I remember my dad came with me when the teacher introduced me on my first day in school. And apparently he asked me to say my name. And obviously I didn't understand. So my dad translated and he told me in Spanish, say your name. And so I just said Laura, because I didn't know that Laura was a thing. And so all of my friends in primary school, and then it went on through high school, everybody would, in an English accent, but they'd call me Laura. And then it was in the world of work, really, when I started working that I was like, oh, I'm not going to explain to every single person that sends me an email or calls me that my name is pronounced differently. But it did, it was like slightly weird. It felt almost impersonal, like I was putting on, you know, a front. So the fact that she is known more widely now as Hilaria or Hilaria, you know, just goes to show that she probably does have a strong affinity to her Spanish roots.
And she doesn't identify with the name Hilary herself, even though she has used it in the past.
Yeah, so I just think it's weird. Like if this was any other type of identity and people would have critiqued it, you know, there would have been global uproar. I think it's a bit
That's
weird.
Really fascinating. I think we're on a brand new trail to follow. And I wonder if people, as they're listening, want to write you their stories about names, because you're right, your name is your essence. But I think what you're saying is really critical, the idea that my name is at the core, and with identity being such a core, how does that happen when kids go to school and their teachers can't say their name? And there was one Kenyan man that I talked to, and he wrote something. He said one of the things is every child needs to know their name is safe in the mouth of their teacher. And I thought, wow, because that's how we do identify. So that's really fascinating what you're saying here to me today. I would guess there's a whole lot of people listening who are thinking, oh my goodness, nobody ever talked about this before, but, and then they would tell you their story. Yeah. So that's kind of how this topic is growing. And it's why it's important, because think of how many people who their very core identity, that very name that they were given at birth that says, this is who you are, isn't even finding space and gets mocked and gets ridiculed, like for Hilaria. I think it's really, really an important key topic that keep thinking about.
Yeah. I was wondering, do you think that this sense of being misunderstood to an extent, even sometimes by your parents, do you think it affects you in terms of building relationships with other people and opening up, I guess?
Sure. I think the two main challenges, as you said, there's many, many blessings. And people say, why don't you talk about the gifts? And I do talk about them, but people get stuck and they can't use their gifts if they get stuck in the challenges. And the two biggest challenges are identity, which is what you've been talking about. And identity has to do with belonging. Where do I belong? That is a huge issue because, you know, we've been made that. And the second issue, which we'll talk about, maybe I'd like to talk about a little bit, is about unresolved grief. Yeah. So if we go back to belonging, it does affect us because this is the thing people say to me, oh, everything's changed. Now there's internet. There's this and that. You know, I'm 75. So when I did all my transitions, basically, I left my world behind me. Now kids can keep up. Well, that's fine. But it's almost intensified, this question of belonging, because there's so many places I could belong. Mm-hmm. But we are made to be relational beings. At the very core of every person, no matter what country you come from, no matter what language you speak, no matter what your ethnicity, no matter what your story is, at the human core is the need for relationship, which is about belonging. I have to be in relationship to people to really even know who I am. Mm-hmm. In the last edition of the book, we talk about mirrors and anchors and how the mirror of the people around me is what tells me who I am. And the anchors are where I feel solid. Well, in our lives, if you think about the ugly duckling didn't know who he was because he didn't have a mirror. He was born and raised with all these ducks, but nobody looked like him. Mm-hmm. So what he kept thinking is, what's the matter with me? And then he finally found another swan and he realized that he was beautiful and he could see who he was because he could see it in someone else. When we're raised, you know, our parents tell us we're loved, or in sad situations, maybe, you know, you can have a bad situation there, but generally you get the sense you're loved. Your parent knows what your specialty is, what your gifts are. But the community would also be able to see that. Are you the soccer star? Are you, you know, the basketball star or whatever? And in community, our community and our families are also within a place, and their parents can help us navigate that place. And when those things stay steady, your mirrors stay pretty constant and your anchors stay constant. But in the world that we live in, if you think about it, those mirrors change. Every time we make a move, the mirror changes. And even when we go with our family, the mirror changes in a way because every family is making that cross-cultural move and adjusting to it in a different way. And as you said, the parents are making it as people who establish their identity in one place. So they know who they are no matter where they go. They got that one down because that's what you're really forming in your first 18 years generally, is by sense of identity. Mm-hmm. So they don't understand why their kids are struggling because we're Spanish. Okay, we're Spanish. My mother said to me once, I never understood you didn't think you were from Chicago until you started doing all this crazy stuff. I said, Mom, how can I be from Chicago? You know, I grew up in Nigeria. She said, well, you're my child. I'm from Chicago. I think, well, that's fine, but I don't know anything about it. And so this starts to start this tension with parents. But the other thing, when you talk about relationships, a lot of times we start to put walls in our relationship because we've moved so many times, or we start to think, relationships are just temporary. And I'm not going to invest because it hurts too much to leave. And actually, we hurt ourselves more when we do that. But it's what we're doing as our protection. I met one girl who decided, she went to high school and she had to make a change. She decided, I'm not going to make one friend because I can't stand to leave. And she went through high school with no friends. And she said to me, of course, she was in her 20s or 30s when I met her. She said, I think I made a mistake. I said, well, I think you made a big mistake, but I understand why you made it, because she had moved so many times before. She didn't want to try again. She didn't want to be hurt. But this is what also hurts people in long-term relationships. When people, you know, get into extended partnerships or marriage, that if we don't learn how to move beyond the wall, that stays there. And that certainly was when I got married. I couldn't figure out why every time I felt close to my husband, I'd make a fuss about something. And I finally realized a long time later that that's how I did my relationships, because I want to be ready when it stops. Now, we've been married 53 years, so we made it. But it really has been one of the things in my life that I've had to work against because of that.
I can so relate to that. Like, I'm very quick to make friends. And I think it's partly because as the eldest, I felt a sense of responsibility maybe to make friends on behalf of the three of us. And so it's interesting because my brother is the complete opposite to me. And I think it might have something to do with being extroverted or introverted. I don't mean in the sense of, being louder necessarily, but I mean, I very much love being surrounded by people, whereas he loves, spending time by himself. And I find it so difficult to say goodbye. I get really emotional. And yeah, my grieving process every time we'd come back in September to go to school was at least a week of just sadness. And yeah, with relationships, I definitely have such a tall wall. Like, I dare anybody to climb it. And frankly, if anybody would, I'd probably push them off anyway.
Even with friends, I found that throughout my life, I never really had friends that I was really, really, really close to. But I think it's because I always, at the back of my mind, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to leave again. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to have a best friend because I will end up leaving. And even when I spent a year in Madrid, 2 years ago, I went to Madrid and I was there for 6 months. I was like, oh, is there any point in me making an effort? Because I know that this will end. I always have that end in sight. So I never really, it's kind of a defense mechanism, I think, being able to be with yourself, happily with yourself, and not put that guard down because you know you're going to lose those people.
Well, I think the problem is, I hear you 100% because it's my story too. But at some point, if you keep waiting to live, you'll never live.
Yeah.
My dad was a TCK. He grew up in Iran. He was American, but his parents were working over there. And he was the one that said to me, I've met so many people that keep waiting to live. He said, no matter where you move, unpack your bags and plant your trees. Because he said, if you don't, you'll never live. You'll get to the end of life and you never lived. And that was a great challenge for me, because he said, even if you plant your trees and you never get to eat from the fruit, somebody will. Mm-hmm. And so the bags, of course, are emotional and physical. A lot of times, we can almost keep our bag mentally and emotionally packed. But he said, when he said that, and I went back after 12 years away from Nigeria and I saw the trees he planted, he was right. Other people were eating from them now, but they were there and they had grown, even though we weren't there. And if I didn't do that, if I couldn't live there, I would have missed living the richness of my life. Because I think after you realize, even if it's a short time, I can really learn, I can be blessed, I can gain so much. Like this morning, we've had this wonderful conversation that I never thought about names. Okay. Now I've got a whole new thing to think about because you guys have put that into my life. I think that is fascinating. So I've learned something. I've grown in this, even this 1 hour conversation we've had. And, I go to a lot of different conferences before COVID. And each person has a story that can add to my life. And of course, I'm not, setting up a romantic relationship with each one, but either I live in those moments when I'm with those people and I gain, and I hope they gain from me, and we grow. In today's world, you can keep some of those relationships going. I can't keep all of them going, but even if they don't keep going, they have become a permanent part of me because I've grown from them. And then, of course, there are the friends you want to have forever. And then the other thing is, it's not a sin to cry when you say goodbye. Because you only grieve for what you love. And if you want to talk about, we can talk a little more about that whole process of how do we say goodbye and grieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, my grieving process, I think, has a lot to do with parents, but with my parents. But I just think it's very, the whole belonging thing is so interesting, because I think I read it in your book. You described Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So for any listeners who don't know about the pyramid, Maslow is basically an American psychologist who identified human needs and categorized them into a 5-stage pyramid. So at the very bottom, you've got your very basic needs like food and oxygen and water. And then you move up the pyramid to get to the top of the pyramid, which is essentially, you know, ultimately, we all want to become the best version of ourselves. And in the 3rd stage, he says we all need a sense of belonging. So what you were saying about humans are communal animals. We like to be with people. We like to have relationships. And I think I personally am somebody who has always really looked for a sense of belonging. We've had the conversation with my brother, and I think for him, it's less salient. Like, he doesn't feel the need to define where he's from or, you know, who he is. Whereas I very much need a semblance of, I belong here, I'm home, you know? And I think that's created a lot of tensions with my parents. And it's potentially because there's times in my life where they've moved us to a different place. We had no say in it as kids. When we were younger, it was easier, I think, but it was my first year of high school in the UK and we moved to Belgium. And I was in the last year of primary school in Belgium, but it corresponded to the first year of high school in the UK. So I was supposed to be going into high school. Then we moved to Belgium and I was still a kid. I was just doing the last year of primary school again. And then when we moved back to England, that's when my relationship with them completely changed. And they assumed it was because I was just a teenager, but really I was being thrown into the 2nd year of high school, having never really experienced the 1st year of high school. And so I still felt like a kid. You know, like a month ago, I was running around in the playground because I was in the last year of primary school and we were playing catch. And now I'm moving to this school where all the girls wear makeup, they shave their legs, and I still felt like a child. And I never had that transition process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that really created tensions with my parents for years.
I hear you. And I think one of the things that I'm also hearing when we're talking about belonging and then why that leads to grief, but one of the reasons it's so important what you're doing is because there is a place you belong, and that is with others of like experience. And that's an invisible place for us until we know that there is a community that is like us here. And I think that's part of the importance of understanding our story and that other people have that story, is because all of a sudden I think, okay, there is a place I belong. I had a really strong feeling of that when I went as an adult to Kenya. And just before I had gone, I was talking to somebody here in Indianapolis about whatever, and I said something about Africa. And they said, oh, people think you're so arrogant because you think you know everything because you grew up, because you've lived every place. And I just started to cry. And I said, if I pretend to be a suburban housewife, I have a place. If I ever let you know who I am, I don't have a place. They said, well, are you just faking it? And I said, I don't know. But we went to Kenya, and the first night there, people were telling their stories about they'd been, I don't know, somebody had been down to Antarctica 2 weeks ago for something. Somebody had been here and somebody had been there. And I thought, nobody's bragging. They're telling this story. And that's when I thought, there is a world I know. I understand this world. They understand me. And when I had that sense that there's this place I do belong, even if it's not, you know, a traditional place, it gave me a different steadiness, I guess, to not demand that everybody know my story and to be interested to know their story too. So I just want to say to those who are listening, it's okay also to belong to a tribe that isn't maybe localized, but it's really a big global community of people who do understand the story once we start to talk about it. And that's why it's so important to share our stories. But then what you're talking about, the grief, you cannot have loss without grief. It's just, that's life. We are also made to be not only relational, we are emotional creatures. And emotions, in one sense, are the universal language. You know, we all can feel sad. We all feel joy. We can feel these things in different places and ways. And so when we move, the more we've loved the place, the more we've lost. When people say, why do you talk about grief? It's so negative. I think, no, it's not negative, because if I didn't love something, I wouldn't miss it. And the problem with our life, well, then grief will come out, as Kubler-Ross defined it, first with death and dying, but it relates to loss of any kind. First, there's denial. And a lot of times I've met people that are in permanent denial, but you can't get into them, like you said, Laura, that they're fine. Everything's fine. No problems. Okay, everything's fine. I'm great. Then we go to an anger phase. And that's, I think, what a lot of times we feel, because anger is easier to feel than sadness, or it can put our energy someplace, and we can, you know, put it on other people. We can feel it. But then after that, there's also depression, and the anger turns inward and we start to feel depression. And so we're flashing out at anger here, but really and truly inside, we feel quite depressed and sad. And then in her stages, you know, you come to maybe some bargaining, you try and figure out how you're going to do it. You come to acceptance. There's a new stage they've added, like, how do I move on and find meaning? But in our particular thing, the thing that I found out when I was 39 and I journaled trying to understand my story was I didn't even know what I had lost. So there was no way to do the mourning. We need to mourn. A funeral is how you take your grief and you mourn it so you can move on. We had no way to mourn it. So I'm 39. I'm writing about leaving Nigeria. And I started to sob and sob and sob. And I realized this was the day my world died. The world I loved. The only world I really just felt so at home in. So when I took that airplane ride, I not only lost the physical world, I lost all my trees that I love to climb. I lost market and I lost the smell. I lost everything that made it home for me. But of course, mentally, it's not home, because I have a passport that says my home is in the States, which is where I'm going. And so there's no funeral. There's no way to say goodbye. And of course, my parents think they're taking me home. And I'm expecting, like you did when you went back to Spain, that it's going to be what it was. So what we've also lost, so we've lost our status. I knew who I was in my community in Nigeria. Suddenly, I had no status. Not that to be important. I just didn't know where I fit when I got to Chicago. And I was in eighth grade. And they all talked about things. I had no idea what they were talking about. And they didn't know who I was. So how do I even use my gifts? What are my gifts? I don't know. They don't know. And so we've lost that. We've lost the world that was. But then we've also lost the world that wasn't. My cousins all experienced things I didn't know. I never experienced them. So I've lost on both sides. But none of those things have names. None of them have a funeral. And so it just goes into this nebulous, unrecognized grief. And then when you talk about the parents, they unknowingly can take away the permission. When I say, why do we have unresolved grief? Yes, we understand why we have grief. That's fair. And it's also why in the work we do, we try to help people, how do you do transition well so that you can deal with the grief when it's happening instead of 40 years later? But the parents don't understand. And so one of the things is we have lack of permission. Exactly what you say. When you tell your parents you're feeling sad, well, you shouldn't feel sad. You're Spanish. Or don't worry about it. Just call yourself Maria. Or whatever it is. It's like, what's your problem? And they don't get it. They don't mean to not get it, but they don't. And or it can be, we're doing this for such a noble cause, if you're in the military or in the mission, or we're doing this for your sake so that you can have a better life. So there's no permission to feel sad, because in another way, what your parents are saying or what anybody's saying is true. So you have a lack of permission. But even at the beginning, what I talked about was lack of awareness. I don't know what I lost. Then I have a lack of permission. Often I have a lack of time. You had a week. You had no place to process it. Grief takes time. Mourning takes time. And it's a process we go through. And when COVID happened, everybody wound up in transition without any time. You know, our lives all changed just instantly. And we didn't even know how we got here. But that happened for you in a physical sense as kids. It happened for me. But especially when kids don't have warning and time. So we didn't have time, we didn't have permission. But then one of the biggest things is we didn't have comfort. When I was doing my journaling and I sent it to Dave Pollack, he sent me back a letter. I said, maybe I'm the only one, but he sent me a letter from a therapist. He had asked her, what is it that you deal with most when you deal with TCKs? She said, a lack of comfort and a lack of what it means to be a person. I didn't understand the personhood. That's about the relationship. I've come to understand that later. But when I saw lack of comfort, I just started crying, crying. And I thought people encouraged me to death. When I went to boarding school and I missed my mommy. Oh, just think about all the kids who don't have a mommy. Okay, well, that's lack of permission, but it's also trying to encourage you. Oh, well, just think tomorrow we're going to do all these fun things. And nobody ever said it's okay to feel sad because they thought it would make it worse for me and it would have made it better. And so one other thing we really have to let ourselves understand and our parents understand is this is a very paradoxical life. It's so good in one level, but it has so many losses. And if they give permission to live in both and the comfort we can give each other, I can tell you that I think I know it's hard to switch when you're that age. And the age that we switch is also important. And we comfort each other. Then we have inside ourselves a place, okay, now I can figure out where I go. But when nobody lets me sit with my grief, all I can do is put it away, but I don't put it away. It goes someplace and it goes behind that wall. And then I'm afraid to take the wall down. So at 39, when I decided, I just had to look and see what was this thing that I couldn't put words on. And I started to journal and I started with my first night in boarding school. And suddenly I could feel all of those feelings that I had tried so hard not to feel when I was six because I had to survive. And as I journaled through it, I finally touched the emotions that I had stuffed and I survived touching them. And that was good because once you let yourself feel it and cry through it, and sometimes people, you know, do that in therapy. I did it through writing. You're not afraid anymore to go there and you can let other people in because our good feelings are also stored in that place. And so that's why I think it's so important for us to learn how do we do grief well. How do we not be afraid of the sorrow, even while we experience the joy, so that we can live in a fuller way?
It's hard to identify because you almost feel ashamed for not being mm-hmm. grateful that you have all these wonderful right. opportunities in one sense. But then on the other side, it's like nobody, even yourself, like I think with the stages that you mentioned, I've, you know, the denial, the anger, the depression, and then finally the acceptance, I can relate to all of those stages. I can place them in that order throughout my life. And it's only mm-hmm. now that I'm really starting to get to the acceptance mm-hmm. phase. I read in your book as well that even organizations should be more aware of this because oftentimes they uproot a whole family and there's mm-hmm. no, you know, it could be costing parents a lot more than they think it does to uproot their entire family because it can potentially completely change their relationship with their child, even if they don't realize it at the time. Like I was absolutely fine. I had a very, very close relationship with my parents. It wasn't until a few years after living in England that my grief started to manifest.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is where the problem can really come in big time. I mean, it's big time when we're depressed and whatever, but how many kids I've met who have had eating disorders or turn to drugs or turn to something else. In that may be extreme. And so I think when you say what can parents do, one of the things, we can't always avoid the moves. Sometimes there's political reasons, there's financial reasons, but we can do it better. And so we try and teach people first to, you know, if you build the raft, reconcile relationships before you go, but also let your child affirm, let them say thank you, let them say farewell, let them say actual goodbyes. It doesn't help to pretend it's not happening. Mm-hmm. And some parents don't tell their kids till right before the move so they won't get upset. Well, that's just the worst thing you can do because we need that time. And after the kid takes the time and you set up even ways, how are we going to stay in contact and, you know, make plans, then you think destination. How are we going to live in the next place? But a lot of people want to think destination before they've done the process of goodbyes and farewells. And I've talked to quite a few TCKs who said, I didn't think that would work because it felt like it would be so painful to say goodbye. But they tried it and they did it. And they said, you know, actually, it's way better. Because when I get on the plane, I don't have to regret all the relationships I just messed up by, you know, being ugly and nasty and everything else. And so I think parents can learn that if we're going to do this, how do we do it well? How do we also listen to the child and realize that maybe we're still going to have to move, but that child needs a place to tell me how it feels. And the parent can be sympathetic. They can be comforting. It doesn't mean that you get on the boat or the ship or the plane or anything else and you go back, you know, that you can sit with them and understand and also have hope that the mourning process takes us to a new plan, a new way.
Yeah, see, our parents, they told us it would be temporary.
Always.
And I think that's where the error was. For years, they would tell us that it was going to be temporary and that we were going to go back to Spain. And the moment never came. And I think that's when the switch hit for me, when I was maybe like in high school. I think actually it's maybe when we moved to Belgium. The fact that we were living in the UK and then moved to Belgium. And then instead of going to Spain, we moved back to the UK. We didn't get a say. And they always said, you know, England's just temporary. And then when after Belgium, we moved back to England instead of Spain, it was kind of like, hold on, these guys are serious. Like, we're staying here. I'm starting high school. This looks like more permanent than we thought.
Well, one of your losses, there's loss of trust.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a big loss.
Yeah.
Because if you've lived expecting to go back, but I think also parents think, we don't want to really tell the kid the truth because they're not going to make it. But you also bring up another really important thing is the issue of decision making. When possible, parents should include the children, because another part of being human is that we are people who have wills, volitional choices, you know, that we've been made, that the capacity to make choices that affect us is important. But when a child has no choice, or what are the choices if we don't have a choice? I had cancer a few years ago. I don't have a choice about having cancer. But you have a choice in the middle of that, how you're going to do it, not just in treatment, but mentally and emotionally. And, you know, there's choices you can make within the non-choice. And I think for parents, as kids are going to move, what are the things you'd like to take? What are the toys? What are your sacred objects? A lot of times parents just don't take things and the kid gets in the other side and say, what happened to my teddy bears, whatever it was. So you can give choices even when the big thing isn't a choice, but what are the choices? So I do think for parents, the more that the child is part of the decision and makes decisions in that process, the more healing it is, the more helpful. The child doesn't feel so out of control. And I think sometimes part of the way people cope is a need to control everybody and everything in their life because they felt they didn't have any choice or control when they were kids. So that's another tip for parents.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I mean, I can definitely relate with the child in that instance. Do you think for people who have had this upbringing as an adult, stating your losses or kind of, you know, because I think it's a process of awareness and forgiveness, I guess.
Yes, I think in naming the loss, we also are acknowledging the severity of it, because one of the ways that permission is taken away is, well, compared to everybody else. And that is a huge thing for us. I think, yes, compared to everybody else, I'm not in the food line. Compared to everybody else, I don't have bombs on my house. Compared to everybody else, so what's my problem? Mm-hmm. But in my story, it's a loss. And that doesn't mean other people didn't lose all kinds of things. But we have to live our story. And the worst thing we can do is compare it to somebody else and then say, well, it doesn't matter. It matters. It's my story.
Yeah, I definitely, I think loss and suffering is, I don't think it's relative. I think it's subjective. I think, you know, different people can experience the exact same situation and react to it completely differently. And nobody can diminish somebody else's suffering or their loss.
And as you say, depending also on personality, mm-hmm. our losses in the same situation can be different. I'm also an extrovert. It is very hard for me to sit here in this house by myself. Mm-hmm. That to me is depressing. My husband can sit here and read forever and he's just in glory. You know, he's happy. This is good. He loves it. I just get itchy. I get irritable. I get depressed. And if we don't have choice, in a sense, we feel like victims, because victims don't have choice. But once we start to find where we can make choices, even if we don't have all the choices, we start to take back a sense of our own personhood, our own need to be able to be in some kind of control. And so what are the choices I can make when they're not all available to me?
Oh, well, Ruth, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. This has been such an insightful conversation, and I have a million questions, so we're going to have to do this again.
You do it again. It's been insightful for me. I've learned all kinds of things. That's why I love doing this. This topic is never ending, and it's always growing, and all the nuances just keep getting more and more and more complicated and interesting. There's a new normal in the globe, and we have to find ways to understand it and look at it and define it for ourselves and hopefully for the good of our globe, because when people can't understand it, they're pulling back into their old normals. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think we're seeing with nationalism and all the separation people are trying to make now, because they've lost a sense of who I am. So the only way I know is to go backwards instead of to realize there's really a lovely way we can connect with each other in these human experiences that transcend all these ways we've defined it before. We need to have a place that we have that passport and there's that kind of belonging. But I believe there are many places that I can feel I belong. Mm-hmm. And my nationality may be one, but the experience and all these other things is a far greater sense of belonging for me, because I belong to a whole lot more people.
It's just so increasingly common. There's so many people that live this way. So I hope mm-hmm. there's people out there listening, other TCKs, who this has helped. Exactly.
And keep telling your story. That I think it's in the sharing of the story we find these commonalities, because you think, okay, the details are different. And we have different passports. We have different countries. But we have a shared story as well. And that's what I think is hopeful and fun and interesting.
Yeah,
definitely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, of course.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We really hope you enjoyed the episode.
As always, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We love hearing from you. Bye.